in-home care long before Coltita reached out to Royce. Tiger had paid for nurses to come in and administer medications prescribed for his heart, his diabetes, the poor circulation in his legs, and the complications from his prostate cancer, as well as provide other medical care. On top of that, Earl had a full-time assistant, a woman who had been at Earl's side for a number of years, to help him with everything from bathing and using the bathroom to transporting him to medical appointments. But in a fit of anger triggered by a misunderstanding concerning Earl's care, Coltita had abruptly fired Earl's assistant, whom she referred to disparagingly as a housekeeper. She was much more than that. The woman had shepherded Earl through some of the loneliest, most uncomfortable months of his life. Royce called the blow-up between Coltita and Earl's longtime personal assistant a kerfuffle. That was putting it mildly. When Coltita lost her temper, those on the receiving end of her wrath would not soon forget. In this instance, the responsibility for cleaning up the mess fell to Royce, so she took a 6-month leave of absence from her employment and began the process of relocating to Cyprus. She moved in with her father and took over his day-to-day care in mid-January 2006. Prior to Royce's arrival in Cyprus, Tiger had spent a great deal of time at the family home on Teakwood Street during his break from golf, especially around the holidays. But he remained purposely aloof from the drama that accompanied his parents' complicated relationship. Dating back to 1996, when Coltita moved into her own place, Tiger was well aware that his father had begun hiring women to wait on him in every way. Coltita always resented these women, but Earl's home was no longer her home, and she largely chose to ignore his choice of company after the separation. It's unclear how much Tiger knew about the details of what went on in his father's house. One individual with direct knowledge of the promiscuous atmosphere there described it as a fucking rodeo. At one point, a young woman who showed up for a job interview wearing a super short miniskirt and cropped halter top promptly took a seat on Earl's lap and hugged him. She was immediately hired to be his executive travel assistant. But by the end of 2005, the environment inside Earl's home had completely changed. He was virtually incapacitated at that point, and the only woman who remained a fixture in the home was the full-time assistant Coltita would soon cut loose. Remarkably, none of the stress stemming from Earl's worsening condition seemed to adversely affect Tiger's golf game. As far back as childhood, he had always managed to thrive inside the ropes despite the dysfunction at home. His most astonishing characteristic, much more so than his ball striking or his athleticism, was his ability to compartmentalize and numb any emotional pain when he competed. When he returned to the PGA Tour at the end of January 2006, he won the Buick Invitational at Torrey Pines. A week later, he won the Dubai Desert Classic. Then he won at Doral. Tiger's streak to start the year was made all the more impressive by the increasing complexity of his personal life. Just days before returning to the tour and ripping off the 3 consecutive wins, he had paid a visit to the Naval Special Warfare Combatant Craft Crewman Training Center in Coronado, California. While there, Tiger got the VIP treatment, visiting with SEAL Team 7, watching a weapons demonstration, and speaking to a class of future SEALs in training. He told them he had wanted to be one of them when he was young. Afterward, in a private conversation with the weapons instructor, Tiger asked how the SEALs managed the stress year after year. "It's a life," the instructor told him. "You just do it. You keep practicing." It was a message that Tiger could relate to. The only thing that seemed to be a consistent source of inspiration was Tiger's foundation and the new education initiative. Back on 9/11, when he was in St. Louis preparing to play in the WGC American Express Championship, the tournament was abruptly canceled. With flights grounded, Woods rounded up a rental car and started driving toward Orlando and home. Alone on the highway for 15 hours, he had a lot of time to contemplate what mattered in his life. With the country reeling in the immediate aftermath of the deadliest terrorist attack in American history, Tiger felt inspired to do something more in the world. He didn't have a clear vision, but he knew he wanted to focus his efforts on helping young people, and he began to see that the Tiger Woods Foundation, as then constructed, was not the best vehicle. A phone call to his father led to a brainstorming session. By the time Woods reached home, he had decided to change the focus of his foundation from golf clinics, which had become something of a circus act and had little lasting impact, and grants to community groups to something more meaningful and lasting, education. The result was a 4-year effort to fund and construct the Tiger Woods Learning Center, a state-of-the-art facility focused on teaching science, technology, engineering, and math, STEM, to underprivileged children. The 35,000-square-foot flagship building was constructed near his childhood home in Anaheim, a city with a high percentage of minority and low-income students. With the grand opening scheduled for February 2006, Woods was looking to generate publicity. His foundation requested that former First Lady Barbara Bush attend as a guest of honor, but after initially accepting the invitation, she had to cancel. Tiger's team then approached California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger, but he was unable to fit the event into his schedule. His wife, television correspondent Maria Shriver, was suggested instead, but she was not quite what the foundation was looking for in terms of star power. With time running out, Executive Director Greg McLaughlin called Casey Wasserman, a prominent entertainment and sports industry executive based in Los Angeles and the grandson of legendary Hollywood mogul Lou Wasserman. Casey, in turn, reached out to attorney Doug Band, Bill Clinton's longtime counselor. Band couldn't help seeing the irony in Tiger asking Clinton for a favor. "Did they tell you the story?" Band asked Wasserman. The story, of course, involved the Jackie Robinson ceremony snub back in 1997, sparking a schism between Clinton and Woods that was later widened by a subsequent Ryder Cup incident in which Clinton walked into the U.S. team's locker room, only to see Tiger walk out. Later, Woods refused to have his picture taken with Clinton when the victorious American team visited the White House. For these reasons, Tiger was sure Clinton would never go for it. The ex-president, he insisted, hated him. Woods would never let a slight go, and he assumed Clinton operated the same way. However, after much wrangling, the former president's people came back and said Clinton would be amenable to an appearance under certain conditions. Tiger had to personally call and make the request. As an icebreaker, he wanted to play a round of golf with Woods in Orange County when he came out for the event, and he needed a private plane to travel to the West Coast. After several moments of whining, Tiger got over his reluctance and made the call. A gracious Clinton put him at ease, and the event and golf game were scheduled. Wasserman had already agreed to provide a private plane, so the deal was done. "Wow, that was easy," Woods told everyone after hanging up. On the day before the official opening of the Learning Center, Woods met Clinton, Doug Band, sports agent Arne Tellem, and Wasserman for the promised round of golf at Shady Canyon Country Club in Irvine. Tiger was having breakfast with McLaughlin in the clubhouse when Tellem and Wasserman approached. At that point, Woods had never met either man. Dispensing with introductions, Tiger wanted to know if the president had arrived. When told Clinton was on his way, Woods replied with a straight face, "I can't wait to talk about pussy." The situation got even more awkward after Clinton arrived. Tiger's behavior did nothing to bridge the gap between him and Clinton. At the outset, Clinton started carrying on, monopolizing the conversation as he was known to do before Woods interrupted and said, "How do you remember all that shit?" Once they got into the course, Tiger acted completely indifferent to the entire group, mostly riding alone in his cart and spending an inordinate amount of time on his phone. After finishing a hole, he would routinely exit the green while others were still putting, a major breach of golf etiquette. When the president hit a wayward drive, Woods snickered. He also told a series of off-color jokes, including his go-to black guy condom knee slapper. "He was really obnoxious," said one observer. "It was so clear to me that day who Tiger really was. I've never seen the president more put off by a person than that experience." To make matters worse, about a week later, Clinton's office sent a picture of Clinton and Woods on the course together and asked Tiger to personalize it and send it back to the president for framing. Whether Tiger forgot or simply ignored the request remains unclear. Many months later, a staffer for Clinton called Tiger's office in exasperation and asked, essentially, what the fuck was going on. At that point, Tiger scribbled his name on the photograph and sent it back. Years later, a longtime Clinton staffer had unpleasant memories from the entire situation. "Clinton hauled his ass out west, and you can't sign a picture?" The whole experience was a lot of, "I'm Tiger Woods, king of the world, go fuck yourself." In his illustrious 25-year career at 60 Minutes, Ed Bradley had profiled a wide range of subjects, from Muhammad Ali and Michael Jordan to Bob Dylan and Lena Horne to Michael Jackson. With his career winding down due to ill health, Bradley had a few major interviews left on his bucket list, one of which was Tiger Woods. Bradley and his longtime producer, Ruth Streeter, had courted Woods for years with no success. That finally changed when Woods, wanting publicity for his new learning center, granted a two-part profile. He agreed to be interviewed as long as the 60-minute segment was built around the grand opening. Woods said no to Bradley's desire to see his yacht. He said no to Bradley's visiting his estate, and he made it clear that Elon was strictly off-limits. "He was really definite about not wanting us to meet his wife," said Streeter. "We went left, we went right, tried everything, but he would not let us meet her." Still, Bradley was eager to ask Tiger about other aspects of his life, the role his father had played in shaping him, how he had dealt with childhood celebrity, and his views on race. The interview took place in early 2006, and Bradley was uncharacteristically nervous. Woods, on the other hand, showed no signs of anxiety. By then, Tiger had gone one-on-one with many skilled interviewers, Charlie Pierce, John Feinstein, Charlie Rose, Barbara Walters, and Gary Smith, and he'd been profiled countless times. The days of telling off-color jokes in the back of a limousine with a journalist or crying on Oprah's couch were ancient history. From the moment he sat down with Bradley, Woods made it clear that he had no intention of opening up about anything. This exchange was typical of how the interview went. Woods: "I'm kind of a private person." Bradley: "So how do you handle it?" Woods: "Try and do the best I can." On the subject of race, Bradley brought up the kindergarten incident, prompting a half-hearted response from Woods. "Well, they tied me to a tree and, you know, threw rocks at me. It happened." When Bradley asked why it happened, Woods said he didn't know. Trying a different approach, Bradley asked what his parents had said about the incident, and Tiger said he couldn't remember. Even when Bradley ventured into safe territory, such as Woods' greatness as a golfer, he churned out short sentences that relayed next to nothing. Afterward, Bradley and Streeter rode together to the airport. En route, like an old married couple, they rehashed the interview. "We didn't lay a glove on him," Bradley said to her. "We didn't touch him." It was a remarkable admission coming from Bradley, whose streetwise style and innate ability to connect with his subjects had established him as the most skilled interviewer at 60 Minutes. His best quality was that he could be spontaneous, said 60 Minutes executive producer Jeff Fager. No matter how the subject responded, Ed could come up with just the right next question. He had even managed to get Oklahoma City bomber Timothy McVeigh to open up about his motivation for carrying out one of the worst terrorist attacks in American history. But Woods proved to be more fiercely guarded than a man facing the death penalty. Even at 30 years old, he was frozen and undeveloped as a person, isolated in many ways, recalled Streeter. There was no there there. To be fair, I don't think Tiger was trying to hide anything from us. I think he was doing what he had programmed himself to do. There was something weird, and we couldn't unravel it. In fact, there was a lot that Woods kept hidden from Bradley, especially with respect to his marriage and his image as a family man. "I have found a life partner, a best friend," Woods told Bradley. "You know, Elin's been incredible for me. She's brought joy and balance in my life, and we love doing things together." In truth, by 2006, Tiger's life was anything but balanced, and nothing was more out of sync than his marriage. He and Elin were seeing little of each other, and when they were together in public, Tiger looked disengaged and empty. Meanwhile, he was spending much more time on the road, where he increasingly pursued other women behind Elin's back. Yet he told Bradley, "Family always comes first. Always has been in my life, and always will." On May 2, 2006, Earl's kidneys started shutting down and he was placed on oxygen. Tiger was with Jamie Jungers at his nearby luxury condo in Newport Beach when his mother telephoned him with the news. Woods immediately drove to the house on Teakwood, where Royce was doing all she could to keep her emotions in check. It was eminently clear that the end had arrived. Tiger spent a few hours with his dad that evening, but then he returned to his condo where he had sex with Jungers. "I could see he was preoccupied and worried about his dad," Jungers would later say. "But when he went to bed, he still wanted to have sex as usual." At about 3 a.m., Tiger was awakened by the phone. Jungers was lying next to him when he picked up and heard his mother's voice on the other end of the line. She had called to tell him that his dad had passed. Tiger didn't shed a tear, nor did he say a word. He'd known for some time that his father was dying, and now the dreaded moment had arrived. Woods hung up and stared blankly. So much has been made of the storied father-son relationship between Earl and Tiger. It's hard to count how many times Woods has said over the years that his father was his best friend, the person who understood him better than anyone else. And the scene of Tiger in Earl's arms after winning a tournament had become so commonplace that the networks always had a cameraman ready to capture the shot at the end of their broadcasts. Yet when Earl passed, Tiger wasn't at his father's bedside, but rather a few miles away, in bed with a lingerie model he had picked up in Vegas. Earl took his final breaths in the arms of his daughter, who had stayed by his side day and night for the final 4 months of his life. "People are aware of how close Tiger and my father were," Royce said. "But they are not aware of how close Dad and I were. I've always been Daddy's girl. When he passed away, it was very hard. I was just lost. Very lost. He was a major, major part of my life." Earl's death devastated Tiger as well. Although he didn't verbalize it, he had lost his best friend, his anchor, the one person who understood him the most. But Tiger didn't grieve in front of others. At a private wake and funeral service held for Earl in Southern California, people who had known him since Tiger first burst onto the national scene, guys like Joe Groman, now the head pro at the Navy course, and golf writer Jamie Diaz, were in attendance. So were some of Tiger's famous acquaintances, such as Charles Barkley and Michael Jordan, as well as Tiger's newest associates, like Hank Haney. They couldn't help noticing that Woods remained stoic when talking about his father's life. And his comments about his father were so emotionless that it was hard for some who were there to remember what he had said. Earl was cremated, and after his funeral, the family flew on a private plane to Kansas to bury his ashes in Manhattan, the town where he had been born. Earl's children from his first marriage always assumed that he would receive a traditional headstone. They were surprised to discover long after the burial that no headstone had been ordered. To this day, the father of the wealthiest athlete in history remains buried in an unmarked grave. It's an inexplicable fact that was still a source of speculation and dismay to certain family members a decade after the fact. Tita handled all the burial and funeral arrangements, Royce said in 2016. So as to why, I don't know. I don't even know if there is a reason. Only Coltita can explain the motivation behind her decision to bury her husband in this manner. But the biggest clue may be found in a statement she made back when Earl was still alive. Referring to him, she said, "Old man is soft. He cry. He forgive people. Not me. I don't forgive anybody." Coltita Woods may have spoken broken English, but she wasn't hard to understand, and no one needed her forgiveness more than Earl. His relationship with her began with an act of betrayal when he brought her to America while he was still married to his first wife. Eventually, he betrayed Coltita too. Along the way, he degraded her with verbal abuse and insults. She bristled when Earl piled impossible expectations on their only child, saying that Tiger had been sent by God and that he would be the most important human ever, and when he hogged the credit for Tiger's success. If it had been up to Earl, his son would have financed the construction of a giant monument with an inscription that said something along the lines of, "Here lies the father of Tiger Woods." But it was up to Coltita, and she buried him in a way that would make him virtually impossible to find. The closest Earl got to public recognition was an obituary in the New York Times. The headline read, "Golf. Earl Woods, Tiger's father, dies." A few weeks after burying his father, Tiger disappeared to a mountainous region close to the Mexican border, outside the little-known city of Campo. Following a winding road that passed through a stretch of barren desert, he arrived at a remote facility called the Mountain Warfare Training Facility Camp Michael Mansour. It was a place where the landscape resembled Afghanistan. In an award-winning profile that appeared in ESPN, the magazine in 2016, journalist Wright Thompson detailed what happened there. Wearing camouflage pants and a brown t-shirt, Tiger carried an M4 assault rifle and had a pistol strapped to his right leg as he entered what's known as a kill house, a place where SEALs simulate clearing rooms and rescuing hostages under extreme duress. With a SEAL instructor running him through the house, Tiger took fire from high-powered paint rounds that caused large bruises on impact. He also fired at targets dressed up as terrorists with weapons. Eventually, Thompson wrote, "Woods learned how to clear a room, working corners and figuring out lanes of fire, doing something only a handful of civilians are ever allowed to do, run through mock gun battles with actual Navy SEALs. With the 2006 U.S. Open just 2 weeks away, Tiger was off the grid, handling guns and dodging mock enemy fire rather than gripping clubs and working on his short game. Even the SEALs were a bit perplexed. One of the SEAL instructors, a petty officer whose father had also served as a Green Beret in Vietnam, pulled Tiger aside for a private conversation outside the shooting facility. "Why are you here?" the instructor asked respectfully. "My dad," Tiger told him, insisting that his father had told him he would be a golfer or a special ops soldier. "My dad told me I had two paths to choose from." This was a new narrative, one that diverged quite significantly from the consistent story that Earl had told about raising Tiger. In the three books Earl published and in the countless interviews he granted over the years, there is no mention of him telling his son that he had a choice between being an athlete or a soldier, nor had Tiger ever said anything publicly about such a decision. But in the aftermath of his father's death, he had a lot weighing on his mind. "I definitely think he was searching for something," the SEAL instructor told Thompson. "Most people have to live with their regrets. But he got to experience a taste of what might have been." Tiger's foray with the SEALs panicked Hank Haney, one of the few people in Tiger's inner circle who had access to his schedule. Haney fired off a text message. "With the U.S. Open 18 days away, do you think it was a good idea to go on a Navy SEALs mission? You need to get that whole SEALs thing out of your system and stick to playing Navy SEAL on the video game. I can tell by the way you are talking and acting that you still want to become a Navy SEAL. Man, are you crazy? That Navy SEAL stuff is serious business. They use real bullets." Woods wasn't crazy. He was suffering and emotionally disoriented. Not long after vanishing into the Southern California desert with the SEALs, Tiger ended up in a nightclub in New York when he spotted a group of women. One of them, Corey Reist, a curvaceous blonde in her late 20s, caught his eye. Reist turned out to be an exotic dancer at the Penthouse Executive Club on Manhattan's West Side. Moments later, he sent an associate over to use the familiar pickup line. "Tiger would like to meet you." As Reist approached his table, Tiger scooted over, making room for her. Then he started telling her jokes. At one point, he put the tips of his shoes together, moving his feet up and down, and asked, "What's this?" Reist wasn't sure. "A black guy taking off his condom," he said, laughing. It was one of the jokes he had told the girls at the GQ photo shoot in front of Charlie Pierce back in 1997. 9 years later, he was using the same sophomoric humor as a substitute for conversation. One of the perks of being a celebrated athlete is that tact and personality are not prerequisites for securing female companionship. After some drinks, he led Reist to a friend's apartment and took her to bed. They exchanged phone numbers and started sleeping together whenever he came to New York. When they were together, he would talk a lot about his father and how he'd made him the man that he became. When they weren't together, Tiger would repeatedly text her, wanting to know whom she was with. As an exotic dancer in a high-end strip club, Reist was used to possessive men. But Tiger was unusual. He was very jealous, she said. It was almost like high school when you call someone all the time. "Where are you? How do you feel about me?" He needed constant attention and reassurance. He needed no such reassurance on the golf course. 6 weeks after Earl's death, Tiger returned to the PGA Tour and played in the U.S. Open at Winged Foot Golf Club just outside New York City. It was the first time in 37 majors as a professional that he missed the cut. But a month later at the British Open, he finished 18 under to win his third claret jug and his 11th major championship. He played so flawlessly that his ball striking was described by even the toughest critics as sheer perfection. His swing coach pointed to Tiger's performance at Royal Liverpool Golf Club as the greatest display of iron play he had ever witnessed. In four rounds, Tiger didn't hit a single fairway bunker. He hit driver only once in 72 holes. Tiger dedicated his majestic performance to Earl, and as soon as he sank his final putt, he did something he hadn't allowed himself to do since Earl died, break down. First, he buried his face in the shoulder of caddy Steve Williams and wept as the two men stood on the green. Then he sobbed like a baby as Elin put her arms around him and he exited the course. "It just came pouring out of me," Woods said. "All the things my dad meant to me, and the game of golf, I just wish he could have seen it one more time. The victory at the British Open marked the start of one of the most sublime runs of Tiger's career. The next week, he won the Buick Open, then the PGA Championship by 5 strokes, making him the first player in the modern era to win more than one professional major in consecutive years. A week after that, he won the Bridgestone Invitational. 2 weeks later, he won the Deutsche Bank Championship. He finished the year by winning 6 straight tournaments, displaying absolute and utter dominance in every phase of the game. But his iron play in particular was what separated him from everyone else. In 2006, Tiger was 8 feet 4 inches better than the tour average with his irons, explained Golf Channel analyst Brandel Chambly. That is unfathomable. A foot would separate 30 to 50 players, and Tiger was 8 feet better than the tour average. Golf historians still point to Tiger's performance in 2000 as the single greatest season in golf history. But in the 6 years that had elapsed since then, he had become a more precise and consistent golfer. In 2006, for example, he won 8 of the 15 tournaments he entered. It was unprecedented in the modern era for a pro golfer to win more than 50% of the time. The most extraordinary aspect of Tiger's splendid display of victories to close out the 06 season was that his game had finally reached perfection at a time when he was struggling more than ever in his personal life. Weeks before his father died, Tiger had been in Las Vegas to film a new commercial for Nike. It was shot by renowned cinematographer Janusz Kaminski, whose work on Schindler's List and Saving Private Ryan earned him 2 Oscars. Tiger dressed in all black for the shoot, which took place in a sound studio. With Woods using his driver, Kaminski filmed him face-on and from several other angles, capturing his swing from takeaway to follow-through. Then he slowed down the sequence to 53 seconds and added a cello solo. The commercial, titled Swing Portrait, was a tribute to the greatest golf swing in history. Viewed another way, the ad ingeniously captured the dichotomy of a man both blessed and cursed by parents who found little in common outside of a desperate devotion to their son, a son whose own life now was, tragically, descending into a similar sense of desperation and sadness just as he finally reached perfection in the game. The man most responsible for this predicament was not there to shepherd his son through the sadness, nor was he there to witness the culmination of triumphs that ultimately emerged from the little boy who had started imitating his father by hitting balls in the garage as a toddler. Earl surely had his flaws, but he was nevertheless the one person Tiger looked to as a North Star. Now that star had disappeared and Woods was indulging in his personal obsessions like never before, forcing him into an exhausting game of lying and covering up more and more to maintain his wholesome image. Tiger, more than anyone realized at the time, was living a lie. Chapter 24. Tick, tick, tick. Tiger Woods met Roger Federer for the first time in New York at the U.S. Open Tennis Championships in 2006. He was in Federer's box cheering him on when Federer defeated Andy Roddick to capture his 3rd straight Open title. Afterward, the world's greatest golfer and the world's top tennis player shared a champagne toast, and Woods invited Federer to come to one of his tournaments. Federer took him up on it, and a few months later, Woods brought him inside the ropes at Douro. It was the start of a friendship facilitated by the fact that they were both generally regarded as the best ever. It also helped that they were both represented by IMG and were the top 2 pitchmen for Nike. We could relate very much to one another, Federer said at the time. We have a lot of expectations from everybody, so we have a lot of common ground. It's good that we kind of know each other and can talk to each other about it. As was the case with everyone else in his life, Woods never revealed much about his friendship with Federer or much of himself to his new friend. But professionally, they shared how they changed their respective sports, Woods revolutionizing a game of skill with overpowering athleticism, Federer transforming an athletic sport with his artistic power and grace. At the start of 2007, there was little doubt in the minds of golf and tennis fans that Woods would eclipse Nicklaus's 18 major championships, and Federer would surpass Pete Sampras's benchmark of 14 Grand Slam titles. The only question, it seemed, was who would reach the milestone first, Woods or Federer? The odds at that point were strongly in Tiger's favor. He had already won 12 majors. Federer, who was 6 years younger, had won 9 Grand Slam tournaments. The two men decided to enter into a friendly wager. As things turned out, Federer surpassed Sampras just 2 years later. Woods, on the other hand, as we all know now, will likely never catch Nicklaus. His sudden demise was something that no one saw coming, not even Woods. But the beginning of the end of Tiger's dominance as a golfer started in the most unlikely of places, in the back seat of his Cadillac Escalade about a mile from his home. In early 2007, Woods had no clue that his late-night ventures into the Orlando nightclub scene had long since tripped the radar of the National Enquirer. In major cities like New York and Los Angeles, the Enquirer made it its business to know what A-list celebrities were doing after the sun went down. To that end, it employed a loose network of women, pretty enough to blend right in at the hottest clubs, then backed up that surveillance with various valets, bartenders, bouncers, and cocktail waitresses at hotels, restaurants, and clubs, along with a stable of young stunners who worked the private party circuit. Everyone keeping tabs for the Enquirer was paid between $200 and $500 a night in cash to inform on the behavior of various actors, comedians, musicians, and politicians known to boost newsstand sales. In 2007, Woods was by no means a sales commodity on the scale of Brad Pitt or Jennifer Aniston, but a fall from grace was a fall from grace, and nobody monetized that kind of misery quite like The Enquirer. The Enquirer was founded in the 50s by Generoso Pope Jr., a mysterious child of privilege with alleged mafia ties who ran the publication for 36 years, turning the words "inquiring minds want to know" into a cultural catchphrase. Pope tapped into the public's fascination with blood, guts, and the bizarre. The publication hit its zenith in 1977 when it put a photo of Elvis Presley in his casket on the cover. That issue sold a record 6.7 million copies. The publication changed considerably after Pope died and the New York-based investment banking firm Evercore Partners absorbed the tabloid in 1999 as part of its $607 million purchase of American Media Incorporated, AMI, owner of most of the nation's supermarket tabloids and gossip magazines. Under the new leadership of editor-in-chief David Perell, the Enquirer began doing more sophisticated investigations. In 2003, it broke the story of Rush Limbaugh's addiction to painkillers. Then in late 2007, it worked on a series of Pulitzer Prize-worthy stories that revealed presidential candidate John Edwards had fathered a child out of wedlock during his campaign. Perell was a big believer in what he called predictive human behavior, and he loved the long game. He famously preached patience when stalking a story. "Never force it," he would tell his staff. "The story will come to you." That is exactly what happened in the case of Tiger Woods. Sometime in 2006, the Enquirer received a tip that Woods was catting around Orlando. The Enquirer soon deployed reporters to various night spots in the city. Club Paris owner Fred Kalilian confirmed that in 06, he was approached several times by the tabloid and offered what he said was hundreds of thousands of dollars for security footage of Woods partying inside his club. "It was all about Tiger," said Kalilian. "I told him to go screw themselves. That's not who we are. That's not what we do." Initially, nobody in Orlando was willing to expose Woods' late-night assignations, not in 2006. Plus, Woods was very discreet when he went to local night spots, usually remaining out of sight in restricted VIP areas and going to great lengths to avoid being seen with women in public places. But outside the club scene, he had become much more emboldened, going so far as to arrange trysts inside his gated community when his wife wasn't home. Just when it seemed the Enquirer had hit a dead end in its attempt to catch Woods in a compromising position, a call came into its tip line from a woman who claimed her daughter was having an affair with Tiger. The caller was willing to provide proof for a price. Predictive behavior indeed. Mindy Lawton worked as a waitress at Perkins Restaurant and Bakery, an eatery where Tiger and Elin frequently went for breakfast. For months, Lawton, dark-haired and shapely, would seat them and take their order. She made two observations. Elin always ordered for Tiger, and the two of them seldom said a word to each other. "I didn't see any signs of affection," Lawton would later say. "I figured he was in a loveless relationship with his wife." And one morning, Lawton felt Tiger's eyes on her. Shortly after he and Elin left the restaurant that day, the phone at the hostess station rang. Lawton picked up. "Hi, this is Ty." "Who?" "Tiger. A couple of friends and I are going out tonight to the Blue Martini, and I was wondering if you would join us." "It's a scenario that's hard to fathom. An athlete of almost unimaginable stature and celebrity has a wife who is considered one of the most beautiful women on the planet, and she happens to be pregnant with their first child. Yet there he is, making a play for the local waitress who serves him and his wife breakfast. That kind of hypersexual behavior, what addiction experts call a hijacked brain, begins to make sense only in the context of sex addiction. Like individuals addicted to alcohol or drugs, those who attempt to fill a void or self-medicate through sex often find themselves powerless, in an unmanageable situation. At a certain point, it's not about pleasure or passion. It's simply a quest for pain relief, no matter the place or the partner. Hours after calling Lawton, Woods had her behind the velvet rope in the VIP alcove at the Blue Martini Lounge. He also had a few of his buddies with him. Whenever he was out in public, at bars or clubs, he took care to surround himself with a few friends to engender a sense of propriety and that he was never seen alone with a woman other than his wife. When he wanted to be alone with a woman, Woods took careful steps to ensure his needs were filled away from prying eyes. "What are you doing after?" he asked Lawton as the bar was shutting down. She had no plans, so he gave her some instructions. At around 3 a.m., Woods was in his black Cadillac Escalade parked next door to the Perkins restaurant when Lawton rolled up in her car. Woods had her follow him through the security gate at Isleworth and back to his house. Without turning on the lights, he took her inside. They barely made it to the couch before he removed her clothes. "We ended up doing it right there," Lawton recalled. He was very passionate and very rough. He tugged her hair. He spanked her. Finally, they were naked in the kitchen with the lights on. After just 45 minutes, Lawton was out the door, leaving just before the sun came up. Disheveled as a rag doll, she felt she had experienced one hell of a one-night stand. A few hours later, Woods showed up for breakfast at Perkins. With Elon out of town, he had a couple of buddies with him. He texted Lawton after her shift ended, saying he wanted to meet again. He brought her back to his house, but this time they didn't even make it inside. While passing from the driveway through the garage, Woods grabbed Lawton by a golf cart, quickly removed her clothes, and lifted her up against the wall. A routine developed for Lawton. Meet in secret. Have sex. Woods was taking bigger and bigger risks. Lawton, on the other hand, thought she was falling in love. She couldn't help telling family members what was happening. And that's when her mother saw an opportunity and called the Inquirer. In exchange for cash, she informed the supermarket tabloid of an upcoming tryst between her daughter and Woods. Tiger was unaware that the Inquirer was unto him and Lawton. When Woods met Lawton in a parking lot early one morning in the pre-dawn darkness, an experienced photographer was on the scene, snapping away. Before the brief sexual encounter, Lawton tossed something to the ground. After Tiger and Lawton went their separate ways, the photographer checked the ground around where Woods' SUV had been parked. He discovered a fresh, bloody tampon. Like a police officer collecting forensic evidence, he placed it in a clear plastic bag. As editor-in-chief of the Inquirer, David Perel was immediately briefed. He then notified David Pecker, CEO of American Media, Inc. "Holy shit," said Pecker, "we've got our Elvis." Nearly one quarter of the Inquirer's weekly sales occur at Walmart. Almost three quarters of all sales are generated at chain stores. It's a readership base that doesn't play much golf and isn't particularly interested in Tiger Woods. But like many people, they're titillated by indiscretions and are definitely interested in highly successful individuals who fail. These are people who live their lives failing, so they want to read negative things about people who have gone up and then come down, Pecker told the New Yorker in 2017. After some internal discussions, Perel placed a call to IMG and left an ominous voicemail. "What is Tiger's relationship, if any, with Mindy Lawton?" Then he hung up the phone. That wasn't the only call IMG received. After Lawton informed Tiger that the Inquirer was aware of their affair, he put her in contact with Steinberg, who told her, "We'll take care of it." Shortly after Perel left his voicemail, IMG called back. Careful not to overplay his hand, Perel mentioned something about photographs, but he did not elaborate. He knew, given the poor lighting in the parking lot, that the photographer had not gotten the shot. The few photos he had taken were too dark and grainy to use in the tabloid, but this information was not shared with IMG, nor would it have put IMG at ease. The fact that the Inquirer was onto Woods and knew about Lawton was scary enough. The situation presented an all-out public relations crisis for both Tiger and his agency. Wood stood to earn $100 million in endorsement revenue in 2007 alone. Some of his corporate partners were certain to cancel their endorsement deals and run for the hills if Woods was caught up in a tawdry adultery scandal. With Perel running point for the Inquirer and Mark Steinberg leading the discussions for IMG, lawyers and executives from both sides engaged in a series of conference calls. Neil Bolton, a corporate editor for American Media, was one of the individuals brought in at the outset. IMG knew they had a problem to handle, and it was intense, he said. Bolton was also the editor-in-chief of Men's Fitness Magazine, another American media publication that was considered one of its crown jewels. From the start, Bolton realized that Men's Fitness was going to become a critical player in the negotiations that were underway between IMG and the Inquirer. Wood suddenly found himself in a very unfamiliar place, as the world of tabloid journalism plays by an entirely different set of rules than that of the collegial confines of the golfing press. Steinberg and IMG immediately recognized that they weren't going to be able to talk the Inquirer out of publishing the story. They were going to have to give something up. Within 24 hours of the parking lot encounter, an exclusive cover story on Woods for Men's Fitness was on the table in exchange for the Inquirer killing the story on Lawton. Bolton, for one, found it distasteful. "I'm sitting there going, whoa, whoa, whoa," he said. "I'm certainly no saint. I mean, I've had drug problems, but that's nothing compared to blackmailing the most popular athlete in the world." In New York literary circles, Bolton was viewed as a figure torn from the pages of a Truman Capote novel. Brilliant, bisexual, and possessing a taste for drugs and self-aggrandizement, he had risen through the ranks of American media to become corporate development editor and oversaw numerous redesigns of The Inquirer and other titles. Given his past, Bolton conceded that he was the last person to grab the moral high ground. But, he said, he simply could not dig this deep into the dirt. As the negotiations between IMG, The Inquirer, and American Media entered their final stages, Bolton left the office on a Friday night and never returned. David Pecker would later say that he didn't see the negotiations as blackmail since he had decided against publishing the story. Ultimately, the two sides executed a contract outlining the conditions of a cover story on Tiger in Men's Fitness. The contract is said to have covered everything from how the headline would read to the fact that there would be no hint of any sex scandal. American Media handpicked Roy S. Johnson, a former senior writer and editor at Sports Illustrated who had known Earl and Tiger for more than a decade, to write the story. "I was not part of Tiger's inner circle, but I did meet Tiger on a regular basis," Johnson explained. "We stayed in touch, mostly through Earl." Johnson said he had no idea how the cover story had come to be. His assignment was to write it, and that's what he did. He spent the better part of a full day with Tiger in Isleworth. Woods liked Johnson, and it showed. He went out of his way to engage with him. Tiger also enjoyed showing off his physique to the photographer. "He was jacked," said Johnson. "He had his shirt tailored so his biceps popped." Johnson was doing double duty as the de facto art director on the shoot. At one point, he wanted to capture the beautiful arc of Woods' swing. The photographer had shot Woods from all sides, but Johnson had one last request. "Is there any way we can get it from the front?" Johnson asked Woods. "You don't have to hit the ball." But Woods wanted to hit the ball. "Here's what you need to do," said Woods, positioning the photographer and an assistant holding a sunshade knot 10 feet in front of him. "Now don't move," he told them. Johnson was nervous. Woods planned to launch a ball off the tee while the cameraman and his assistant were directly in front of him, and Tiger had given himself only a 10-inch window to hit through. Woods took full swing and hit the ball exactly where he wanted, over the parking lot and into a nearby lake. Not once, not twice, but 6 times. Johnson's 3,500-word cover story hit newsstands in late June, right after the 2007 U.S. Open. It portrayed a smiling, absolutely ripped Woods under a blaring headline in red: "Tiger, his surprising workout, how he got big." Over 12 splashy pages filled with photos of Woods working out, Johnson delivered an upbeat profile that referred to Tiger's weightlifting levels as off the charts, and even mentioned that he was about to become a father. The Mindy Lawton story simply went away. Woods had long ago learned that he was above the rules. It was a lesson his parents started teaching him at a young age and was reinforced by his experiences as an elite golfer. As early as his sophomore year of high school, he was allowed to enter his first PGA tournament under an exemption that was accorded him by the individual in charge of the Los Angeles Open. An exemption is a term of art in golf, but it was a way of life for Woods. His escape from accountability in the Mindy Lawton affair took the rules don't apply to me mantra to a perilous new level. On one hand, Mark Steinberg's masterful handling of the Inquirer situation probably qualified him to be a candidate for Fireman of the Year. After all, there was no question that Tiger had been stalked by the Inquirer. It's also true that he had been targeted to a certain degree by Lawton's mother. But none of this would have been possible if not for the fact that by the summer of 2007, Woods was acting out of desperation. Although the depth of his problems may not have been known to his agent at that point, the nature of his involvement with Lawton was a big red flag. An athlete worth $1 billion sneaking off for an early morning quickie in a parking lot is not the behavior of a husband who has strayed. It's more like a man lost in the wilderness who desperately sends up a signal flare in hopes of being rescued. Even before the ink had dried on the deal that IMG struck to avert the Inquirer story, Woods was pursuing another young woman. This time, it was a 21-year-old cocktail waitress from San Diego. In April 2007, Jamie Grubbs and a group of girlfriends went to Las Vegas for a few days of fun. It seemed like the perfect way to celebrate the fact that Grubbs, a 5'7", 105-pound blonde, was now old enough to drink legally. On their first night in town, they went to the nightclub Light. Before long, a VIP host brought Grubbs and her friends complimentary drinks and led them to a table occupied by a group of men. Grubbs was stunned when she realized that Woods was one of them. She didn't know golf, but she certainly knew Tiger, and it felt surreal when he showed an interest in her. At the end of the night, Grubbs and her friends filed into the limo with Woods and his friends. After her friends were dropped off at their hotel, Grubbs was invited to Tiger's suite at the mansion. His friends tried to persuade her to get into the jacuzzi with them. "No offense," she told them, "but I'm not doing the hot tub scene with four boys and being the only girl." That night, Grubbs fell asleep on Tiger's couch. The next morning, she awoke to the words, "Are you ready for your massage?" A massage therapist gave her the first professional massage of her life. The cost was $400, and one of Tiger's friends instructed her to sign for it and tack on a $100 tip, all of which was billed to Tiger's room. The friend then took Grubbs on a shopping spree. They drove a Rolls-Royce Phantom that Tiger had at his disposal for the weekend. That night, wearing a brand new dress that Woods had paid for, she partied until 3:30 a.m. with her girlfriends before being picked up in a stretch limo that delivered her to Woods. She ended up sleeping at his suite again, and for the second straight night, Woods was a gentleman. In the morning, she awoke to the sound of his voice. "Wake up, Sleeping Beauty," he told her. They had breakfast together in his dining room, and then he had a plane to catch. As she helped him pack, Grubbs playfully pushed him onto the bed. Woods gave her a goodbye kiss and promised to call her the next time he was in San Diego. For Grubbs, it was like experiencing a scene from Pretty Woman, only this wasn't a movie and she had no idea what she was getting into. She didn't even realize that he was married. "Never in a million years would I take him to be a ladies' man," she would later say. Woods, by this time, was accustomed to dealing with women who were much more familiar with the ways of the world. One such woman was Michelle Braun, a notorious South Florida and Southern California madam who ran a high-end escort service known as Niecy's Girls. Braun reportedly earned at least $8.5 million and employed scores of women at a time, providing playmates, pets, porn stars, and party girls to men who were willing to spend five and six figures for the pleasure of their company. Woods started going to Braun well before the Inquirer episode. According to Braun, Tiger's friend Byron Bell usually made the arrangements, but there were times when Woods was in a pinch and Braun said he would make the call himself. He'd say, "Hey, it's Tiger. I'm going up to L.A. for a meeting. You got anybody in Orange County today?" Initially, according to Braun, Woods was interested in the clean-cut girl-next-door type, and he was paying five figures for a weekend. But after a while, Braun set him up with one of her most exotic women, Lordana Jolie Ferriolo, a former Hawaiian tropic model and Playboy playmate whose matchmaking fee ran as high as $100,000. She had been matched with some of the richest men in the world, Saudi princes, heads of state, CEOs. Ferriolo claims that Woods paid $15,000 for their first date, financed shopping sprees, and flew her to the Bahamas, Dubai, and Las Vegas for secret rendezvous. In the midst of all this chaos, Elin gave birth to a baby girl on June 18, 2007 in Florida. Hours earlier, Tiger had finished second at the U.S. Open at Oakmont in Pennsylvania. His final putt stopped a foot short of the hole. Furious at himself, he didn't say a word as he left the course and headed for his plane. He landed in Orlando around 11 p.m. and went directly to the hospital, arriving just in time to see the delivery of his first child, Sam Alexis Woods. She arrived 13 months after the death of Woods' father, and her name has its roots in Tiger's relationship with Earl. From the time Tiger was little, his father had sometimes called him Sam. It was a nickname that no one except Earl used, and then only in certain situations. When he wanted me to know that he was there, to reassure me he was behind me no matter how I did, he called out, "Sam," Tiger said. He used that name off the course as well. It always made me smile. One of the first people Tiger called to announce that he was a father was Hank Haney. Tiger looked at Haney as a true friend, although he didn't always treat him that way. But Haney and caddy Steve Williams had emerged as stabilizing influences at a time when Woods' world outside the ropes was running wild. Despite all the drama and turmoil in his personal life, Tiger played phenomenally well in 2007. Of the 16 tournaments he entered, he won 7, including the PGA Championship, his 13th major. He finished first in every major category, first in scoring average, first in money leaders. He was the PGA Tour Player of the Year for a record 9th time. But 2007 was the first time Haney started to think that Woods, as he put it, was closer to the end of his greatness than he was to the beginning. The signs were too subtle to spot in tournaments. They were more apparent in practice sessions and in the shot dispersion charts kept in testing sessions by the gurus at Nike Golf. There were subtle changes below the surface, Haney said. Tiger's work habits started to slip. There were more distractions. The most obvious distraction was Tiger's cell phone. It was constantly blowing up with text messages and phone calls. Haney had no idea that Woods was communicating with women. He just knew that the interruptions were affecting Tiger's concentration and practice. Rather than vent directly at his pupil, Haney voiced his frustration by making fun of Tiger's outdated flip phone. "I was always giving him shit," Haney explained. "When are you going to get rid of that stupid flip phone?" Tiger had his reasons for not upgrading to a smartphone. One big benefit of a flip phone is that texts don't pop up on the screen, a feature that makes it easier to conceal incoming messages. He had lost contact with Michelle Braun by the time her home was raided by the FBI in October 2007. She later surrendered to federal authorities, who charged her with money laundering and transporting an individual from Orange County to New York City with intent that such individual engage in one or more acts of prostitution. In 2009, she pled guilty, paid a $30,000 fine, and served time under house arrest. But by then, Woods had established a vast web of women whose names and numbers were stored in his cell phone. Jamie Grubbs was only one of many. After initially meeting Grubbs in Vegas, Woods had her stay with him at the W Hotel the next time he was in San Diego. The more time they spent together, the more urgent his text messages became. "I will wear you out soon. Send me something very naughty." This was a long way from "Wake up, Sleeping Beauty." The significant uptick in distractions caused by Tiger's cell phone was another red flag that his personal life was amiss. But Haney and Williams were much more concerned about something they both could see happening before their eyes, the breakdown of Tiger's body. In 2007, he was often in physical pain, and Haney and Williams both attributed it to his extreme workout regimen and fascination with Navy SEAL training. When Tiger first participated in training exercises at Fort Bragg right after the Masters back in 2004, it was essentially a one-time experience, a chance to bond with his father at a time when Earl's health was rapidly deteriorating. But since Earl's death, Tiger's fascination with the military had morphed into an obsession. Haney believed that Tiger's interest in becoming a Navy SEAL had gotten so out of hand that it was putting his health and his game at risk. Williams had similar concerns. But Tiger ignored them, stepping up his SEAL activities. He started training in army boots and going for military-style runs while wearing a weighted vest. And in 2007, he upped the ante, embarking on a series of SEAL trips on which he trained in parachuting and urban warfare. On one trip, he visited a special warfare SEALs unit in Coronado 2 days before playing in his first PGA tournament of the year at Torrey Pines. While there, he made connections with a number of SEALs, including one guy whom Tiger ended up hiring as his personal bodyguard. He started showing up at Tiger's home, teaching him self-defense, and occasionally spending the night. Williams, in particular, didn't like the influence Tiger's new bodyguard was having on him and feared Woods was going to get hurt during his rigorous training routines. Tiger had told both Williams and Haney that he was thinking of leaving golf to pursue a career in the military, but when Haney suggested as much to Steinberg, he was essentially told to calm down. "He's not going to do that," Steinberg said. "There's no way. He can't. He's got obligations." But Steinberg didn't realize what Woods was doing when he was off with the SEALs. In one 3-day training exercise, he did as many as 10 parachute jumps per day, and Tiger admitted to a friend that he had injured his shoulder on one jump when he collided with a partner. In another instance, Woods was doing urban warfare training exercises when he was shot in the thigh with a rubber bullet, leaving a baseball-sized bruise. "I screwed up," he told Haney. "In a real mission, I probably would have gotten my squad killed." "My squad?" Woods was sounding more and more like a wannabe SEAL and less like the number one golfer in the world. One day when Haney was in Tiger's living room, Woods put his arm around Haney's neck to demonstrate a SEAL training move. "From here," Woods told him, "I could kill you in about 2 seconds." Another time, he told Haney he was taking concrete steps to qualify to join the SEALs. When Haney pointed out that Tiger was 31 and the age limit for the SEALs was 28, Woods insisted that they were making an exception for him. Exasperated, Haney decided to make a last-ditch effort to bring Tiger to his senses. Standing with Woods on the short putting green at Isleworth, right next to a sand trap, he asked, "Doesn't Jack Nicklaus's record mean anything to you?" Woods stopped, looked him in the eye, and said, "No. If my career ended right now, I'm happy with everything I've accomplished." "Tiger, you're destined to be the greatest golfer in the world, not a Navy SEAL. You need to get that stuff out of your mind and start thinking about what you're doing here." It didn't register. Tiger's longtime trainer, Keith Clevin, had his own concerns, namely that Woods was becoming so muscle-bound that he was stressing his joints. He was also afraid that all the military training, especially the extensive pull-ups and running with weights, was putting too much strain on his shoulders and knees. Clevin shared his concerns with Haney and Williams. Haney, in turn, talked to Steinberg, who finally acknowledged that the SEAL training routine had to be addressed. "I'm going to have a talk with Tiger," Steinberg told Haney. On July 30th, 2007, Steinberg hosted a dinner at his home near Cleveland. Woods, Williams, and Haney attended. After the meal, Steinberg took Woods into his home office for a private conversation that lasted close to an hour. 5 days later, Tiger won the WGC Bridgestone Invitational at Firestone. 2 weeks after that, he won the PGA Championship. Then he won the BMW Championship and the Tour Championship in back-to-back weekends. He closed out the year by winning 7 of his final 8 tournaments, finishing 2nd in the only tournament he didn't win during that stretch. Steinberg appeared to have gotten through to Woods. The way Tiger finished 2007 was nothing short of jaw-dropping. About to turn 32, he sat with New York Times golf writer Larry Dorman for a profile. Dorman argued that time was on Tiger's side for him to break Nicklaus's record of 18 major championships. Even Nicklaus was saying as much. "I would think that if Tiger stays healthy, he will break it," Nicklaus said. When compared with the performances of every great golfer who had preceded him, Tiger was indeed headed into what should have been his prime years. But Woods was unlike every other great champion. Among other things, he never allowed anyone to closely examine him or see what he was really thinking. In his profile, Dorman mentioned a website that compared Tiger to God. At a subsequent press conference, Woods acknowledged being aware of the site, but said he hadn't visited it. When asked if he was officially denying his deity, Woods smiled and said, "Man, I'm so far away from that." Chapter 25. It's Just Pain. Tiger had been playing with a severely compromised ACL for years. Back in 2002, at the time of his first knee surgery, Doctors told him that only about 20% of the thick ligament connecting the thigh bone and shin bone of his left leg remained intact. After playing for nearly 5 years on what amounted to borrowed time, Tiger felt something go in his knee in July 2007, but he chose not to tell anyone that he was hurting. His thought process was consistent with that of other elite athletes who try to play through pain. There's a difference between being hurt and being injured. If I'm hurt, I can deal with pain. Pain is no big deal. I can block